This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, conversation with Northwest Indiana attorney and former mayor of Gary, Indiana, Scott King. He was mayor from 1996 to 2006 after he left office. And we'll talk with him about his time as the head man involved with economic development at the time for the city of Gary and how things stand these days. Also, to another conversation from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. Ed Feigenbaum, who is the editor and publisher of Indiana Gaming Insight, will also join us as well from Indianapolis, talking about some Indiana gaming topics, including a change in ownership for a Northwest Indiana casino boat. And we'll also have a conversation with the Save the Dunes executive director, Natalie Johnson. All coming up. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have an opportunity to get a little history lesson here about the city of Gary from a man who lived it, and in fact still does every day. He's an attorney here in Northwest Indiana now and a consultant, but back in the late 90s and into the 2000s, he was mayor of Gary. We're talking about Scott King. In fact, he's on the phone with us from his office here in Northwest Indiana. Thanks for being with us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure.
Well, first, for anybody who's listening that may not be familiar with Scott King, tell us first about yourself here, and especially when you got involved in city government in the city of Gary.
Well, I first ran for office, for the office of Mayor of Gary in 91, and then in 95 we were successful, and I served until April of 2006 as mayor.
What was the city of Gary like at the time that you decided to run for office for the city of mayor, or for the post of mayor?
Well, there were several events happening. I mean, the collection rate on property taxes was not good for several reasons. You know, crime was on the increase. There was a lot of budgetary issues. And this was shortly after I took office, the casinos first came in, which provided some relief on the capital side of the ledger for the city. But then, of course, shortly thereafter, within a couple of years, we had the property tax issue, which was the reduction in relative share that big industry, in our case U.S. Steel, was required to pay. There was also a transition to market value. And then there was the act by the legislature in terms of the 1% limitation for residences. And made for a very difficult spell in terms of revenues for the city. You also had happening beginning in 2000 a pretty substantial reduction in some of the traditional funding grant sources, particularly for law enforcement from the Department of Justice. So, you know, it was a challenging time. We made a lot of infrastructure investment, invested substantially in the police department in terms of wages as well as equipment and training, and those are the big, the big events that took place.
Mm-hmm. Was this about the time that we started to see the effects of the changes in the steel industry, not only the loss of business, but also how the steel industry changed its ways of operating? We had a lot of people that were working in the mills, and then they had some automation and some other changes with equipment and all, and found that they didn't need quite as many people to run the mills as they used to. Was this about the time, too, that some of these changes were taking place?
Well, really, the transition by the mills in terms of its employment roles really began a lot earlier. I think the last big transition in that regard occurred in the early to mid 80s.
Mm-hmm.
With the advent of automation in some regards, some competition. There was also an impact by NAFTA in terms of increasing the pricing competition for more basic steel products that was taking place. But yeah, I mean, a combination of events reduced the number of employees for U.S. Steel. In some cases, there was some offset by contracting, you know, with third-party companies to perform functions that the mill had done itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then since I've left office, they've, you know, closed down the coke batteries. And so it can, you know, it continues to be an industry very much in transition. I have read recently where we're starting to see a pricing, some pricing increase and an upswing. I think Mittal seems to, at least internationally, be leading the way. But I think the last quarter there was some improvement by U.S. Steel as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the, you know, I think at its height there was approximately 20,000 employees. And, of course, at its height, the vast majority of those employees also resided in Gary. And going back to the 60s, it started to change with the advent of interstate highways, the advent of suburban development, particularly mall development. And, it was a story not just for Gary, but I think it took it impacted in a lot of ways urban centers throughout the country.
You certainly had an awful lot on your plate, certainly at the time when you became mayor of Gary, to try and deal with all of these changes and everything that happened. Like you say, the loss of business that had been in downtown Gary, they'd been moving out into Maryville and other places over the years, too, and all the changes that had happened in that respect as well. I know that you worked very hard to help improve the city of Gary, and not only dealing with the crime and the other problems with the blight that had happened, but also, too, that you brought some ideas in that were pretty innovative at the time, I know, bringing in, which, of course, luckily still is around, is the baseball team. And I know that they've been in efforts to try to bring basketball into the city of Gary, and it's kind of at least fallen off temporarily, but I guess not dead. So you've done what you could, I suppose, to be able to make improvements and keep business and bring new business into Gary.
Well, you know, you have to improve public safety. That's key. Yeah. Then the whole business of the baseball stadium was really to get people to reconnect and come in to try and build up a marketplace for private investment in the downtown area. You know, and just take some initiatives in various neighborhoods to do the same, and some of that's continuing now under the current leadership. I think one of the more exciting things going on in Gary that I see is in the proximity to the IUN, the University Park undertakings. I think that bodes well. The university has made over the years some significant capital investment. I periodically hear renewed talk of something we discussed back during my tenure of, you know, looking for a hospital, university hospital component.
Yeah.
Tie into the medical school, which does hold classes at IUN. So I think some of the same things are being undertaken. I think in some respects, the current leadership in Gary has at least some of the same and some new challenges to continue to try and make that happen. And one of the other pieces I continue now as a resident of Gary to be hopeful for is just increased public and private investment in the lakefront area.
Oh, yes.
Not only in Miller, where I live and have lived since 1980, but on the west side in proximity to the casinos. I think that's still holds a lot of promise for future development.
I'm glad you mentioned some of the things that you've seen in the improvements here in the recent years, and I was going to ask you more about that, Scott, to talk a little bit more. We're talking, by the way, with the former Gary Mayor, Scott King, who is now an attorney here in Northwest Indiana and very much involved in the communities that he lives in and that he likes so much. He ran for mayor and was reelected and has had a chance to see make the changes over the years. You were talking about the changes that you have seen here that have happened in recent years. Is there anything else that you've maybe and certainly endorsed and helped support over the years that you'd like to continue to see happen in the Steel City?
Well, one of the things that we were very much involved in, and that I'm happy to see continued focus on by the administration currently, is at the airport. That continues to be, I think, a real plus. Not only for the city of Gary, but regionally. I was recently at a unveiling, ribbon cutting, whatever, for the Gary Jet Center. They built a beautiful new lounge area attached to one of their several hangars that they built for the corporate aviation, which is a significant arm of revenue generation for an airport operation.
I suppose, too, you also have seen, of course, you know about the situation with having brought Boeing to their operation out there at the airport as well, too.
All related, and
making sure that there's some strong infrastructure out there that, in turn, if more plans are ever made to boost up the airport itself, that's all set there.
Yeah, Boeing came in during my tenure. A lot of work. Gentlemen, I used to labor mightily for the airport, a guy named Bill Staley. And there's a guy still there, the main guy for the Gary Jet Center, Will Davis, who for years was also a next-door neighbor of mine, has really been a major player out there. He's done a lot of investment. I think they're getting ready, for yet another hangar expansion, and these are big pieces. They finally got the something that got started during my administration. Finally, the runway extension was done, which that was an unbelievably complicated process. And I give credit to Mayor Freeman Wilson for bringing that to fruition. I think there's a lot of things. In fact, when I went out there for the ribbon cutting, I noticed a very significant access road improvement underway on, I think they call it Airport Highway now, historic industrial highway. So there's a lot of good things. And just to the north of there, you have the now shuttered NIPSCO Generating Station, which I would like to see go away. And that's right in line with the current crosswind north-south runway at the airport, which is a much shorter runway. And it's not hard to envision the potential in the future for that runway, the crosswind runway, to be expanded northward and really continue to help generate some investment in reclaiming some historic industrial property for new uses, commercial, transportation, and potentially even residential.
I know you've watched how things have changed there at the airport, and note that there have been efforts made to try to bring a commercial airline in, Allegiant, among others, trying to get them interested in Northwest Indiana and using the Gary Airport in particular. Do you think that this potential expansion of that runway area where the NIPSCO vacant plant is now, that was going to be something that might make things a little easier to be able to accomplish?
Well, I don't think in this era, and it really began post 9/11, that you can singularly focus on traditional passenger carriers. Mm-hmm. You continue to try and get them. But they contracted to such a large extent. you know, it contracted in terms of number of venues they serve, contracted in terms of the number of carriers. You know, U.S. Air is a thing of the past. You can go down the list. You know, United merged with Continental. U.S. Air was taken over by, I think, American Airlines, and the list goes on. So they have a disincentive to spread out their bases of operation. And in our particular case, given our proximity to O'Hare and Midway, it's a real challenge. And I think that the smart move currently to keep activity and therefore revenues up at the airport is to do what's being done. Okay, if while we continue to try and get a traditional passenger airline in, let's continue to enhance the facility for corporate aviation, so-called general aviation, and also freight. You know, I think a lot of us think of freight as being limited to some giant, you know, 747. But there is a lot of smaller aircraft. A number of companies, Ford is an example, manufacturers, rather than warehouse inventory and parts and what have you, they kind of rely on a next-day approach and utilize air freight. And I think that's got a lot of opportunity. The city has recently, I think they recently announced that they've been approved, at least at some level with the federal government, to get a customs facility there.
Right.
That, of course, is an enhancement to permit international, again, passenger, yes, if we get it, but also freight. So I think that's the approach right now. I don't think we've seen a lot of startup airlines. And the capacity at O'Hare and now Midway is such where I'm not sure that's an immediate on the horizon. But as they continue growth at those venues for the traditional passenger air, that should, and I think has, freed up some opportunities for the corporate, for the freight, and develop that way. But have the facility in a position where, should the demand patterns change and an airline want to not be at either Midway or O'Hare for whatever reason, we got to have the capacity there to accommodate the aircraft.
Well, you know, there are a lot more things we can talk about and some other areas, too, I'd like to be able to get into with another conversation. I hope we have you back on again soon to talk about things, not only in the city of Gary, but here in Lake in northwest Indiana as well, too. And we do appreciate you spending some time with us today. For somebody who's busy with law practice and everything else that you have on your plate, we certainly appreciate you taking some time out to talk with us here on the program.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and I wish you and everybody a really good holiday season.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Scott King, former mayor of the city of Gary, and now involved in his law practice here in northwest Indiana and as a consultant as well. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Our next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
So when I first came to campus, one of the problems that I experienced was, where do you get a haircut? I made the mistake one time of letting someone in Valpo cut my hair, and that was the last time I did it. But when I first came to campus, people told me, hey, we usually get together on the weekends, we pull our money, a couple of dollars, and we go rent a wreck. And when they explained to me what that was, they said, we rent the car so that we can go to Gary to get our haircut, because there's no place in Valpo that you can get your haircut for African-American students. Particularly funny story about the rent-a-wreck. It was my sophomore year in college. We had all decided we were going to get together that weekend and rent a car. There were five of us that got together, $2 each, to rent the car and drive back and forth. Well, of that five, some of us had classes one time, some of us had classes another time. So three of us went in the morning, two of us went in the afternoon, and then we returned the car later that day. We got a call maybe about 3 weeks later from Chief Lloyd and from an officer who wanted us to come in and interview us. So immediately we all got kind of nervous as to, you know, why would the police department want to be interviewing us? When we came in, they sat us down in separate rooms, interviewed us at separate times. When they interviewed me, I remember vividly them asking me, why do you guys rent cars on the weekends? And I was, again, that curiosity came up. Why am I here to talk about why we rent a car and why I'm getting my hair cut? Well, it turns out they had a rash of burglaries in the community. And after doing some investigating, they figured out that a group of African-American students on campus would rent cars, go to Gary, come back, and on that particular weekend, we went twice. So they thought we were fencing stolen property and taking it back and forth to Gary, and that we did that on two occasions. I found that curious because they didn't understand the whole concept of why you have to travel all the way to Gary just to get your hair cut. And anyone who knows, cutting African-American hair and cutting a Caucasian person's hair, there's differences to it. You can't cut my hair with scissors and make it look decent. You just can't. You have to use clippers, and not everyone is skilled in using clippers. So we had to school them on the art of getting a haircut.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. The number of craft breweries in Indiana has nearly tripled since 2011, and an increasing number of people have been trying to make a career out of this growing industry, but only a small number actually have the skills necessary to land a job brewing beer or running a tap room. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier tells us that a new class aims to change that.
Many of the cars driving along West Main Street in Bloomfield are just passing through.
We all grew up in Bloomfield, and over the last, 30 years, we've seen a lot of businesses leave town.
That's Steve Corbin, a Bloomfield native. We're standing inside what may have been the longest-running business that sits along the small town's main road. It closed its doors after nearly 80 years last October.
Last fall, I guess, this building was still an operating feed store. J.D. Holtzclaw and his family had operated the place since 1938.
But soon, something new will open in its place.
We're going down the ramp into what used to be the area where they had all the bait and feed.
Steve and his wife are stripping the building down to reveal its bare brick walls and decades-old windows. It's empty now, but they plan to open a brewery here within the next year. They're calling it Feed Store Beer Company, in homage to the building's history.
So our idea is actually to still have the bar right here, right where J.D. Had his counter.
It's an ambitious venture for a couple with no background in the brewing industry. So the Corbins participated in a new program at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, to try and prepare themselves for the job. The 7-day Essentials of Brewery Operations Certificate Program is a crash course in everything from world beer styles to the legal issues that need to be considered when running a brewery. Craft brewery educator and consultant Ron Smith teaches the program.
We do focus pretty heavily on brew deck, actual brewing operations. But we also get into cellaring and packaging and sanitation issues and lab processes and tests and quality control stuff.
The course is designed to give students a step up when it comes to getting a job in craft beer, which is an exploding industry in Indiana. According to the Brewers Association, craft breweries have a $1.3 billion economic impact in the state. Sun King Brewing Company is one of the largest, not only in Indiana, but the entire country, and it's been open since 2009. Co-founder and head brewer Dave Colt says they've been growing ever since.
This year we're going to do about 38,000 barrels in total production. That puts us in the top 100 of craft breweries in the United States.
The increase in production and distribution means Sun King's workforce is growing, too. Colt says they have a total of about 100 full-time and part-time employees. But when positions open up, Colt says they struggle to get qualified applicants.
When we're looking to hire, we usually do that from within because there isn't a whole lot out there.
Colt says many people don't understand some of the basic mechanics that go into brewing. So he's hopeful courses like IUPUI's can address the skills gap and give breweries a larger pool of potential employees. The course was nothing short of life-changing for Stacy and Steve. Stacy says she wasn't much of a beer drinker when they enrolled, but now she has a passion for a wide range of beer styles and a more viable business plan.
When I first went into the class, I was just thinking I'll maybe learn how to brew beer and help out. Didn't realize how many aspects of owning a brewery there actually was.
Steve says they're hopeful that extra knowledge will translate into success for their future brewery.
We wanted to see something else good coming to the community, give something back to the community, be able to create jobs in the community, and bring people here for more than just passing through.
It's a business they'd like to see stay open just as long as the one that came before it. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The latest edition of Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter has for main headline, Buyout Fever Burning Up Indiana. Well, to get some explanation to this and a lot of other topics on Hoosier gaming issues these days, including those here in Northwest Indiana, we turn to Ed Feigenbaum. He's the creator, the editor, and publisher of Indiana Gaming Insight. Ed, thanks for being with us once again.
Great to be with you, Chris.
Get to the hard facts and the hard numbers of business, as usual, here in Northwest Indiana. And you talk about the possibility of a change of people, leadership, and at the helm of some of the Indiana casinos and two groups in particular here. Tell us about the latest topics of the changes in ownership that we're facing here in Indiana as well as here in Northwest Indiana.
Well, all of a sudden we're facing a situation where basically all but three of the casino or racino properties in the state of Indiana will have multiple ownership. They'll be owned by the same company in a couple of different cases there. And instead of having, 13 different casinos or racinos owned by different casino operators, you will have at least four, maybe five casinos owning multiple individual Indiana properties. Here's the breakdown. And the one that your listeners may not know about actually happened yesterday. The Pinnacle Entertainment Company, Inc., and Penn National Gaming Company decided that they would go through with their merger. They announced that yesterday morning. And Pinnacle, of course, is the owner of Ameristar Casino East Chicago. They also own Belterra Casino Resort in Switzerland County, down in the Cincinnati market on the Ohio River in the southeast corner of the state. As part of their deal, the Penn-Pinnacle deal, there were a number of different properties that exceeded the ownership levels in different states. There are a few states that the two companies operate in which restrict the number of licenses. In Indiana, you can't have more than two casinos under the same ownership, and that was a situation in some other states too. So as part of this deal, they cut a deal to divest some of those properties where they were over the limit in different states, including Indiana, to Boyd Gaming Company. So Boyd Gaming, which owns Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, will take over the Belterra Casino Resort from this new combined Pinnacle Penn Gaming combination. And Pinnacle, the new Pinnacle, which will be the combination of Pinnacle and Penn Gaming, will own the Ameristar Casino in East Chicago and the Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, which is the largest casino in the Cincinnati market on the Indiana side. So you've got that combination. And then the one that's most intense interest, I think, in Lake County is the Caesars Entertainment Corporation buyout of the two Centaur racinos in central Indiana. Now, Caesars, of course, owns Horseshoe Casino Hammond. They also own Horseshoe Casino Southern Indiana. And some of your more discerning listeners will probably be wondering, well, wait a minute, with the two casino ownership limit, that puts them over the the number that they can legally own in Indiana.
Right.
Well, you'd think that that was the case, but legislators did not include the Racinos in that license, the two license limit, when they passed that law a few years ago. So Caesars can come in and sweep up those two Racinos as well. Now, you already have Majestic Star, the two Gary casinos, under the same ownership since Barton Entertainment bought out Trump Indiana years ago. And in addition, you've got multiple ownership in, one other market, I believe. And so you only have three different casinos, Tropicana in Evansville, and Tropicana and the Rising Star Casino Resort in Rising Sun. And, that's basically it. That will be without multiple ownership.
Mm-hmm. And we find, too, I suppose they also wanted the opportunity to branch out across the state, and they can do that now, I guess, with the Racinos, because both of them are in central or southeast Indiana, in that area there. So they're away from the region. They won't be interfering with the business up here, I would imagine, then.
Well, one would think that would be the case, although, yeah. Those are essentially Indianapolis market casinos, and they will be full-fledged casinos most likely in 2021 when the restriction on the two casinos being able to have live table games expires, and they will essentially be land-based casinos right outside of Indianapolis. And that's led, I think, some legislators to question whether the two license limit should apply to the Racinos as well, because they will essentially already be positioned as the two closest casinos to Indianapolis, and they will be land-based, and they will have all of the advantages of all of the other casino properties.
That's right, yeah. And the two that I guess this concern, I'm sure that probably comes up, it hasn't been mentioned yet, I suppose, is that, the competition, if you have these casinos in Indianapolis, people that from Indianapolis now coming up here to Northwest Indiana to do their gaming at the boats, they won't have to do that as much anymore.
That's certainly the case, and it really affects the southeastern Indiana casinos a little bit more than the northwest Indiana casinos, though.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But everything goes out the window, Chris, as we've discussed. When the Pokagons come into South Bend early next year, and we just don't know what to expect, but we will see a diminution of the Indiana commercial casino market as a result of the Four Winds Casino opening in South Bend.
Yeah. And I know that you spend space and time in putting things together for the Indiana Gaming Insight newsletter, talking about the fact that the Native American gaming is coming in the state more, and the changes are happening, so people can keep track of that as well too, with the subscription they can get to the newsletter too. You talked a little bit here, I guess, about the changes with Ameristar, and I guess we haven't talked all that much other than just what you mentioned the last time we talked here about what they're doing at the expansion of the East Chicago facility, going into land-based areas of the facility up there that they have set aside for doing that. They're shifting around of the games and that sort of thing. So I guess we see all these changes
right.
Starting to take place now.
Yeah, absolutely. And your listeners got the exclusive last month on the lowdown on that $5.8 million off-boat expansion by Ameristar. And I hope they appreciated that. And the other thing that goes along with that is that you're going to change the policy on counting admissions, and you probably won't see admissions be quite as important a factor in Indiana casinos going forward. We've already made the change as of July 1 where the casinos aren't going to be taxed on admissions. And as a result, you're going to see casinos stop counting them. You're not going to be able to have some of the same metrics that we've had over the years, like win per admission and things like that, be added up. And we also won't know the kind of detailed information that we've been accustomed to for the last 25 years, basically, about the number of visits to the individual casinos.
And I know that we talk an awful lot about here in Northwest Indiana about the casino boats and the land-based operations as they're shifting around and expanding. One of the things we probably should mention, too, is whatever that we will see up here, if there's any changes that will come about, I'm sure, with the Hoosier Lottery as they do some shifting around, because they're in competition with the casinos anyway, aren't they?
Absolutely, and the lottery was kind of banned from any kind of expansion, banned from any kind of online gaming in the Pence administration, even as all of our surrounding states, Illinois, Michigan, Kentucky, and Ohio, went to some form of online lottery gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And there was kind of a sore point with Governor Pence. They even wanted to do some things about checking numbers for this bingo game online, and it looked a little bit too much like a live bingo game. And the governor's office said, no, we're not going to let you do that. But if you look now at the latest offering from the Hoosier Lottery, they've got this new online jackpot game that they just debuted maybe even this week, that is essentially like a live kind of draw game.
Mm-hmm.
You can find out immediately whether you've won or lost, and you know, that brings a different element to the lottery portfolio. And I think that, you know, as the baby boomers age out in the next couple of years, and as millennials start to look more and more at lottery products and don't use the kind of traditional lottery products, and like they don't like slot machines at the casinos, I think you're going to see a move by the state of Indiana and the Indiana State Lottery Commission to some type of online gaming. It's almost inevitable. We're seeing it all around us, and we're seeing it in some other states as well. It's actually the Midwest has kind of driven the online lottery business. You know, I mentioned that all of our surrounding states have it, but that's unusual because I think there are only about 5 or 6 total in the country that do that right now, and we just happen to be right in the middle of that particular hotbed.
Mm-hmm. We have spent some time, I think last time we talked in more detail about what may come about here as we get even closer to the start of the 2018 General Assembly session. It's the 30-day session, the short version of the legislative session, and I'm not sure if there's very much that's likely to come out of this particular session that's going to make an impact on the casinos or the racinos around Indiana.
Well, there are always a few things that they're looking to do, and they've got a little bit of a wish list, and individual casinos will have some kinds of issues and questions as well. You know, obviously the industry consolidation thing will be something that the legislature will take a very close look at. But
yeah,
if you look at the composition of the legislature and who's been elected in basically, you know, the last 4 or 6, maybe even 8 years, you'll find that it's a much more free market oriented legislature and set of legislators than we had before. So that may not be of particular concern to individual legislators,
right.
But they will be concerned about, you know, the impact of the South Bend Four Winds Casino, and the legislators from St. Joseph County in particular will be looking to defend their new casino that will be giving benefits to the people of South Bend in particular, and the government there, from any kinds of outside attacks. You know, there was an attempt in the last session to legalize video gaming terminals just for St. Joseph County so that the state could kind of get its nose in under the tent in St. Joe, and also, you know, perhaps preempt to a certain extent the Pokagon Casino, but that move didn't find any kind of traction whatsoever. But there are a lot of eyes as well, Chris, on the big Supreme Court case that was heard just a week ago last Monday, involving the state of New Jersey and the Professional Amateur Sports Betting Act,
right,
from 1992. And there's a very good chance that 25-year-old law may be overturned in the next couple of months. And if that happens, there will be a rush by not only the states, but the casinos and the professional sports leagues in particular to try and get some kind of sports betting laws on a state-by-state basis. And there may be you know, some stomach for that in Indiana. You know, we're obviously a sports-crazy state. And at the same time, you realize that the lead plaintiff against the state of New Jersey in this whole lawsuit over sports betting was the Indianapolis-based NCAA. So, you know, there may be some legislators that could be sympathetic toward, you know, the NCAA and their investment in Indiana, and all that they're bringing in terms of all the tournaments to Indiana. And so we're not quite sure how that might turn out. But there are all kinds of different things that may still, you know, find their way into legislation in 2018, including, you know, perhaps the revival again of that concept for a land-based casino in Terre Haute that got considered last year and didn't lose but didn't get enough votes. It was a tie vote in the Senate Committee on Public Policy to get out.
Yeah, the legislators over there in Terre Haute and in Vigo County, or that area there, are certainly going to be doing their best to try to get it back through in this session too, if they possibly can, to be sure. So, there are a number of things that we don't think about that come under the umbrella of gaming or gaming related topics that the legislators might slip in during this short session. We'll just have to wait and see what happens when they get back to work next month. Ed Feigenbaum is the creator and the editor and publisher of Indiana Gaming Insight Newsletter. And as always, thank you for spending some time with us to talk about these little intricacies that happen and how the changes sometimes kind of blend together. We don't always see them happen and don't always see them take place here, but it's nice to know that you're there to keep an eye on these things in more detail, and you can bring these out to us. We thank you very much for being with us to talk about them today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and happy holidays to you and all the Lakeshore listeners.
Thank you very much. We appreciate that. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Now, the Northwest Indiana Partnership has picked up some funding for restoration work on a very important part of Northwest Indiana's flora and fauna. And we'll find out more about it by talking with Natalie Johnson, who's the executive director of Save the Dunes here in Northwest Indiana. Natalie, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me, Chris.
We note that Save the Dunes, along with the Shirley Hines Land Trust and the Dunes Learning Center, are going to help share a grant that came from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund recently for doing some extensive work in an area that many of us know about. Maybe people have traveled on or been around, but they don't really know very much about the Little Calumet River. I guess we see more of it in particular here in Lake County, where it's more urbanized these days, but there's a lot of great wildlife to check out on the river itself. Tell us, if you will, a little bit about how important the Little Calumet River is to the overall scheme of things, so to speak.
Oh, well, the Little Calumet River is a hidden gem, Chris. It runs through the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, is really a premier spot for paddling, birding, fishing, you name it. It is almost a wilderness. And so part of the restoration efforts that we are doing in partnership with Shirley Hines Land Trust, the Dunes Learning Center, the National Park Service, and the Northwest Indiana Paddling Association is trying to restore that land and then also create some more access points to get to that and really enjoy the gem that it is.
What do people see typically when they're going to the Little Cow? Of course, is in the urbanized area, is just the river itself. You get to see little stretches of it, very naked stretches, to be speak, especially if you go through areas where it crosses highways in Hammond and in Highland and all. But you don't really see all of the real landscape of the Little Calumet River until you get almost to the county line, don't you?
And so it's the East Branch that really is pretty. It's hidden by trees. It's a lot more wild, I would say, that East Branch. So, yes, people think of that West Branch as more urbanized, but the hidden treasure lies in the East. Chesterton, well, right around in that area.
What has it been that folks have been able to enjoy the most about that branch of the Little Calumet River, especially since we've had the restoration work underway?
Well, with this grant, we're continuing our restoration work, but just recently, this past year, we were able to open 8 river miles through the park, through the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, and also outside of it, so leading through it. So people are now able to paddle into our national park and alongside some of the Shirley Hines Land Trust properties. So that work is continuing, and now we continue with this new grant from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund to continue restoration, put in some more access. So people are really going to be able to look forward to getting out there and see that wild land, that wild water that I talk about.
Mm-hmm. What type of opportunities do folks that get out there, to, not only just to walk around, take a look at everything that's out there, but actually to experience the activities on the river itself? What do they get to do? Is it mostly just like paddle boating or kayaking or that sort of thing?
It's kayaking. If you're into paddleboarding, there are areas to do that. I will say it's a nice challenge for any paddler, and that's because there are still a lot of log jams that are in the river. In fact, with some of the work that Save the Dunes has been doing in partnership with the Paddling Association and other partners, we have been very selective in removing only partial woody debris so that there's still plenty of habitat for fish and all the other special critters that live there. So with those log jams then becomes a unique opportunity for people who are navigating in a kayak or a canoe or even a paddleboard to navigate around those log jams. Mm-hmm. Nice challenge, lots of fun.
Is it turned out that you're trying to do a balance between what recreational activities happen there on the Little Calumet River, there on the East Branch, and being able to keep it as pristine as you possibly can?
Absolutely, and this is what this partnership has been striving for. Every partner wants to see this area protected and the streams thrive, and so everything has been done with creating access without harming the resource.
Now we know, of course, now we're into the winter months, but when the weather breaks again here in the spring, is that when we're going to likely see more real restoration work continue out there on the East Branch of the Little Calumet River?
Absolutely. As soon as you see things warm up, partners will be out on the ground getting work done, and this work will continue all the way on through 2020.
Now, you talked about some of the partners here. Go in a little more detail here. Besides the Save the Dunes efforts into this, what are some of the other partners that are being able to take advantage of this Chi-Cal Rivers Fund grant this year?
So I had mentioned Shirley Hines Land Trust, which owns a lot of fabulous properties along the East Branch Little Calumet River. They have been doing a wonderful effort in acquiring a lot of the properties outside of the National Park Service boundaries and restoring those using Chi-Cal Rivers funds. So those are some pretty incredible areas that actually right now we are working alongside with Shirley Hines Land Trust to get access, better parking, trails, kayak and canoe launches, so people can access through there. And when we start talking about kayak and canoe launches, of course, we're also talking about the Northwest Indiana Paddling Association, who has been an incredible partner, and they have been working to give their expertise on the access side of things and also remove some of those log jams I mentioned in a way that doesn't hurt the resource. Mm-hmm. Of course, you have the National Park Service that's guiding all of this with their experts, and we are absolutely thrilled this year with this new grant funding that was just recently awarded to be working with the Dunes Learning Center and NIPSCO. In partnership with those two groups, there are going to be stewardship efforts on NIPSCO's right-of-way, which is basically right-of-ways are an invitation for invasive species. And so working together, they're going to combat that, make sure the area stays pristine, and they're also going to use a lot of those Dunes Learning Center students to get out there, get their hands dirty, and do the stewardship themselves, a really meaningful activity.
That's great.
So lots of moving parts, lots of partners. It's the only way that we can do it in the spirit of collaboration.
Well, Natalie Johnson, thank you for the information. We appreciate that, and congratulations for you and all the other partners on this, getting the opportunity to use some more funds once again from the Chi-Cal Rivers Fund, another grant from the organization based out of Chicago for all the work that they do here in Northwest Indiana as well as over in the Chicagoland area too, and put some money together and use that for the project there on the East Fork of the Little Calumet River again.
Thank you, Chris. Looking forward to seeing people out on the water.
We're talking with Natalie Johnson. She's the executive director of Save the Dunes. And Save the Dunes, along with the Shirley Hines Land Trust, Dunes Learning Center, and a number of other partners, are going to be able to take advantage of a Chi-Cal Rivers Fund grant for more than $275,000 to be able to get some more restoration work done along the East Fork of the Little Calumet River here in Northwest Indiana. Congresswoman Susan Brooks represents Indiana's 5th District, which includes the north side of Indianapolis and the neighboring urban, suburban, and rural counties. But she's also chairperson of the House Committee on Ethics. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin met with her recently to ask her about the recent string of sexual harassment allegations in Washington and the attempts to investigate them.
You, earlier this month, along with a colleague, sent a letter to a congressional office looking for information on sexual harassment claims. Can you talk about what you heard back after you sent that letter?
Sure. What we did, the House Ethics Committee sent a letter to the office called the Office of Compliance.
once the sexual harassment allegations became so prevalent, not only on the Hill, but in the country, we learned that there have been a number of matters that have been settled through mediation and through settlement funds. And we have realized that we, the House Ethics Committee, have been left out of that process. So we asked the OOC Office of Compliance if they would share with us any and all claims of any workforce discrimination. What we've learned through this process is that the statute, the Congressional Accountability Act, there are provisions in the statute that require them to keep them strictly confidential. And so they indicated that while they would like to share them with us, the statute does not permit them to share them with us. What we have learned through all of this is our process in law and our processes in the House are broken. We are the disciplining body of the House. We are the ones that require House members as well as employees to abide by the code of official conduct. We're the ones that do those investigations, but we've learned that the process is very broken. And so there is a group, a lot of people, in a bipartisan way, looking at all the processes in the House. How can we fix them as quickly as possible?
I'm not familiar with the history of the Ethics Committee and how this whole process has worked, but I think a lot of people listening to this will think it's a little hard to believe that this is the first time this has come up, that you're all sort of just finding out now that this policy exists and that you can't get this information. Do you know if this has come up in the past? Is there a reason why this is just now being discovered?
Well, I think I've been on the Ethics Committee for 5 years, and I have to say the issues that OOC has resolved, they, and I asked them this during a hearing that I participated in, I asked if they inform complainants that they can come to the Ethics Committee and file complaints with us as well. They indicated that they do tell people that, but that it's often left up to the employee to decide. That is a process that has been used in the House, and we are really questioning at this time. And I will tell you, I did not know that prior to all of this coming to light. So it's not been something we've tackled and dug into and knew about and covered up.
There's also the acknowledgement right now that there's a culture in a lot of different industries and businesses that allows for this to happen. Do you think that that culture exists anywhere in D.C. and certain pockets that has been unchallenged?
Absolutely. I do believe that. I believe that, you know, we are learning and hearing about and are encouraging people to come forward to us if they have been subject of sexual harassment in any way, shape, or form, because there is a lot of power issues in Capitol Hill, whether it is a member, whether you're chair of a committee, whether you are a boss. But I think that we're seeing a cultural shift in the last few months, and it's giving victims and complainants a voice. Unfortunately, this is the type of behavior perpetrated by a very, very small number, but often taints the entire group. And that's why we've got to know about it in the House Ethics Committee. We've got to investigate it, and we got to hold our members accountable.
That was Congresswoman Susan Brooks talking with Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. Thanks very much for being with us. I'm Chris Nolte. We'll be back with you tomorrow.